the corner waiting, watching time go by. Will I go on to work today, or shall I bide my time? 'Cause when I see that union man walking down the street, he's a man who decides if I live or I die, if I stop.
All this month, Women's History Month, we've been profiling women who are reviving the union movement, like Cobus Keisha Williams, we spoke with just earlier. Yet over the last few decades, unions have lost ground and now represent just 10% of U.S. workers, down from just over 20% in the early 1980s. There's no doubt that lost ground is linked to the increasing power of corporate interests that have rented Congress and have a real edge in the courts. But the union movement itself has its own internal test, living up to its ideals, as we saw how it handled the challenge presented by the Me Too movement. That's when women in the film and entertainment industry blew the whistle on long-ignored male behavior that ranged from criminal sexual assault to workplace bullying. Just how should unions in these workplaces handle these issues? And what happens to the women that risk everything by coming forward? Back in December 2017, after an expose in New York Magazine, WNYC, the nation's most successful public radio station and the place I spent a few years, found itself ensnared in its own Me Too scandal. With us now is sound engineer and podcast producer Debbie Daughtry, who from 2001 to 2020 was a broadcast engineer at WNYC and a member of SAG-AFTRA. Good morning, Debbie. Thanks for joining us. I should mention that a lot of our listeners probably know you from your work with WFMU. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me. That's right. I did volunteer at a radio station WFMU for about 20 years, and that's how I discovered WNYC. That's how I came to WNYC, because a lot of people at WFMU also work at WNYC. You know, it's kind of sister stations in a way.
Right. So there are people that love radio, and I'm sure management's figured that out. They see us coming. Right. Oh, this person loves to work.
She will work for free.
Exactly. First, by way of introduction, what was your path to your career as a sound engineer? I read a 2017 Atlantic Magazine article to prepare for this interview that said that STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math careers like yours, they're male-dominated. That's certainly been my observation. What's been your experience?
Oh, yeah, it's totally a boys' club, and I've always known that. But, you know, when I was in college at the University of Georgia, I volunteered at the student-run radio station there in the 1980s. This was when REM was, you know, just starting out and all those other great bands there in Athens. And I loved it. I just got the bug. I got the radio bug. And I did the oldie show there for a few years until I graduated. And then, you know, where do you go from there? There's no radio stations in Georgia, really, you know, maybe a couple. But I knew of WFMU through the internet. So I ended up moving here. I sold my house and moved to New York City and started volunteering at WFMU. And, wow. You know, I did a radio show called Air Check, which was just a spotlight on, you know, old DJs that I liked.
Wow. So you're really actualizing here. And then I guess for the public, the timeline to the WNYC Me Too crisis starts with, like, as I said, the 2017 disclosed as New York Magazine article that blew the issue wide open. You had raised concerns about sexual harassment and bullying at the station long before that. How did station management respond, and did you feel supported by your union, SAG-AFTRA?
Well, I started at WNYC in 2001, and, you know, I noticed that there was a lot of bad behavior going on. And, you know, I brought it to the attention of my boss and the person above him, his immediate supervisor. And, you know, they basically told me the same thing. Yeah, that's just the way it is.
Wow. We saw the board of directors, WNYC's board of directors turned to Proskauer Rose, a management-oriented firm, to be kind, to conduct an internal investigation of the allegations raised by the New York Magazine article. Not surprisingly, the firm wrote that the station's management was responsive when complaints were raised, taking, quote, significant and prompt disciplinary action, close quote, against offenders. What was your experience? Did you ever get interviewed as part of what was purported to be an independent probe?
No, they didn't interview me. And the when that magazine article that you referenced in the cut came out, that was the first that I had heard of, you know, what was going on at the station outside of my orbit. You know, I didn't realize that it was happening to other people. I thought it was just me. And so when I realized that those women had gone straight to the top, the very top, to a woman, by the way, and, wow, you know, they were told to just not talk about it anymore, I realized that, you know, me going to my boss wasn't going to solve anything because there's nothing he could do if the top can't do anything about it. And so everyone knows you don't go to HR, right? That's, everybody knows that. They're not on your side. But I was in a union. I was in SAG-AFTRA. And I felt like they would have my back if I came forward and filed a sexual harassment complaint. And instead, I felt like I was the one that was on trial. I was the one that was questioned over and over repeatedly. But they couldn't ignore me anymore because I had tape of this audio tape. I had audio tape of what I was telling them was happening there. So, you know, you can't really deny that.
Right. And as you say, don't ever, you know, get the engineer mad. From the standpoint of having documentation of it, so it sounds like you were a threat to the kind of system that was working there. And I guess then one of the things that happens here is that, my wife's a compliance attorney, and Debbie often talks about this concept called moral injury, which is what happens when you can be Keisha Williams, a corrections officer, or EMTs, females that are working in these positions, or even men who find themselves targeted in these bullying situations. And it's a concept called moral injury.
I'm glad you brought that up because, yes, it is also men.
And so this question about moral injury, like, that's the other aspect of this, is that you do what you're supposed to do, and then the system doesn't work, and then you end up being targeted as the problem.
Well, they'd like to set an example. You know, this is what will happen to you if you, you know, cause problems for us. This is what's going to happen to you. So they discourage people from speaking up. And I think that more people need to speak up because it makes it easier for all of us to speak up. It's really hard. It's really hard to come forward and talk about this stuff. No one wants to talk about it. No one wants to hear about it. But we're not going to change it. It's not going to stop happening until we do talk about it.
And one of the challenges in the return, you're kind of fading out, so I'm not hearing you a little bit. But so just so you, I can ask you about this. The union will say that they're in the position of sometimes they're representing all parties in this, the person that's a victim and the person that is who's done the bad behavior. It seems to me, and I've seen some discussion about this, that the unions themselves need to not just put the onus on management. So I'm hearing from you that there needs to be a standard of conduct that the unions themselves need to have people comply to as being members of the union.
Yes, definitely.
Now, and you subsequently worked for WNYC and were part of the engineering crew that kept the station on the air throughout the pandemic. What was that like? I understand you took the lead in advocating that you and your coworkers get hazard pay.
Well, Bob, this is how they get you. You know, you when there's a crisis, you have to go to work, right? You know, the city needs you. You got to get in there. And I mean, when I started, it was 9/11. And then there was just one thing after another after that, you know, up to Hurricane Sandy. And it just becomes part of who you are, you know. You can't sit at home and listen to the radio. You need to be there. And so, you know, they had a shortage of engineers and they called me back. And I really had nothing to lose at this point. You know, I'm not an employee here anymore. I know the union's not going to do anything to help me. So I just said, you know, there's only five of us coming into the station every day. We should be getting hazard pay.
And I was like,
no. I mean, we realize now how important engineers are at a radio station.
Well, I was thinking, and you did get the hazard pay, right? I mean, how much was it?
Yes, it was $75 extra every day. So it almost made it, you know, worth working there. It almost brought the pay up to a living wage.
Listen, do you mind if I give your phone number to some municipal unions, EMS, Municipal Labor Committee? Maybe you could do like the tutorial for them, because an awful lot of people talked about essential workers and how now at this time of national emergency, we'll have hazard pay, and it never happened. So I am actually glad.
There's strength in numbers. There's strength in numbers, whether it's a union or whether it's just five people that are controlling the situation. They can't go on the air without an engineer.
That's true, as I've experienced. And so this question, though, of the power of union. So that must be the thing that the potential for it is. And that's why I guess I would say we don't want people to give a hope on the unions. The way to engage, as you have with the institutions, including unions, is to make yourself present and make your voice known, which you certainly have.
Yes. I mean, I think that the union is there for the collective, right? They're not there for each individual. They're fighting for everyone's rights. And they do a lot of good things. You know, there's a lot of great things about working at WNYC that are because of the union.
Right. And I guess, so what was your experience like working through COVID? I mean, being that essential person that's alone on the train.
No. We were taking cars in to and from.
I want you as my shop steward.
Well, I mean, things have changed a bit, Bob. Things have changed, you know, things have changed there. There is a whole new management system.
Okay, so that sounds like a positive move. So let's talk about what you've been doing since, because you've been really involved with a lot of different things. What is Boss Radio 66? And is Tom Hanks a good DJ?
Yeah, actually, it's a 24-hour web stream that, you know, I started just for fun. It's just oldies music with old promos and jingles. And, you know, it sounds like an old radio station from the 60s and the format, you know, Boss Radio. And I actually met Tom at the NPR Bureau. He was one of my clients there for All Things Considered. And we just got to talking about radio, you know, for like half an hour. And I told him about my stream, and, you know, I said, why don't you do a DJ show? And we talked about it for a while, and more time goes by, and finally he agreed to do it. So now he's done like seven shows for us, and he's a fantastic DJ. He's a natural. Really... You gotta hear it.
Yeah, I will. And so also, you're involved with podcast production. Talk about that, and what kind of opportunities do you see for women in this field now? It seems to be really opening up. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I was lucky. When I got laid off at WNYC, I was able to pick up work, you know, pretty regularly from women who had also worked at WNYC. We have a very good network here in New York City. So, you know, for instance, Janet Babin had gone to Wall Street Journal, and she hired me for a job. And Jen Hugh also hired me, you know, so we have this network here of women looking out for each other. So I actually have been doing better than ever now that I'm independent, you know, because I can take whatever job I want.
Well, and it's true. It seems that throwing out the rope ladder for those behind us is so critically important. What would you say? I mean, there must be, I'm sure, thousands of Debbie Daughtrys out there at a college radio station. What would you tell them? What are the characteristics that they need most to persevere anywhere where they're trying to make a living as an audio engineer?
Well, you have to really love what you're doing, first of all. You know, it's it's not an easy career path.
And I guess networking is key. Is there like an association of female audio engineers? And if not, why haven't you started one?
Well, I mean, do we really need that, though? I mean, come on, it's 2022.
Right.
I'm well, there seems to be a female. Can't I just be an engineer?
Yeah, you can, except I've noticed that men have been using exclusive clubs to create the architecture of the patriarchy. So, and it seems that informally that you've been involved with this network that works out. In terms of, at this point, do you feel that there's been any improvement in the union situation?
I mean, there wasn't for me, and there wasn't for, you know, people that I've spoken to. But, you know, they did have several members leave just this year. I forget what the number is, but there were quite a few people left the station. So I think that's been a strong message. We'll see what happens from here. I don't know. I'm not there anymore, so I don't know.
Right. And we do know that there's a National Labor Relations complaint that's pending related to the dismissal of the shop steward. Debbie, how can people get in touch with you and how can they follow your work?
Well, my website is bossradio66.com, and you can find out all of my information there.
Thanks so much, Debbie. I really appreciate it for giving us this insight behind the microphone and the studio wall.
Thank you, Bob.
That was Debbie Daughtry, former WNYC engineer, independent podcast producer, and I would say a feminist and labor activist on her own terms. Thanks so much for joining us. Tune in here tomorrow for Frenchie Davis at this time, and Democracy Now! Is up next.
You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you, Bob Henley, as always. Bob Henley, Mondays, kicks off the week, Mondays at 7 a.m. Frenchie Davis here tomorrow. Coming up at 9 o'clock, right after Democracy Now!, will be Law and Disorder. And after that, at 10 a.m., we will bring you, at 10 a.m., the program Sounds Like Hate.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York with a moment in women's history. Shirley Chisholm was the first black woman in Congress, and in 1972, she became the first woman and first black American to seek the nomination for President of the United States from one of the two major parties.
I am a woman with ability, with intelligence, and with depth. That is the sadness about this country. And that's why I made my mind up. I was going to stay in this race, come thick or thin. And I was going to go all the way to Miami, because even though the papers have been underscoring me, even though many people have been saying, well, she can't be serious, they're going to see me in action at the national convention. And I mean this. I am committed to this as an instrument of people in this country who've been left out, an instrument of people whose counsel and advice has never been sought. In terms of putting a ticket together, only using the people every 4 years for their votes. I look at all of these distinguished senators telling all of the people what they're going to do for women, what they're going to do for blacks, what they're going to do for Chicanos, what they're going to do for this group and the other group. Well, darn it, they've been in the United States Senate for 10 or more years. If they had a concern about the American Indian, they would have done something already about the miserable living conditions that those Indians live on in terms of the reservations, where 70% of them don't live to see the age of 40. They don't have a concern about women. They don't have a concern about the conservation and preservation of human resources. They're only interested in these human resources every 4 years when it's time to go out and get the vote. And that's why when people say, well, what makes you so different from all the rest of them? I said, I am different because I have a gut commitment to people, first of all. All of the rest of them have commitment to different interest groups, financial groups, power groups. I'm espoused only by a lot of folks in the country who told me they didn't want to vote between the lesser of the two evils anymore. They wanted to give their vote to somebody that they knew deep down within themselves had a commitment to people. And for whatever that vote would mean, at least it would give me that much more added strength that I need when I get to the convention.
Chisholm retired from Congress after serving seven terms. In 1983, she said she wanted to be remembered as a woman who dared to be a catalyst for change. You can receive our Women's History audio collection with Shirley Chisholm and other trailblazers by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member for $15 a month. You'll also receive our fabulous tote bag. Please go to women.wbai.org. Again, that's women.wbai.org to become a buddy in the name of your favorite program. Or call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and say, yes, certainly, I want to become a WBAI buddy this Women's History Month.